Maybe you remember that ad. It ran for weeks, premiered at the Super Bowl earlier this year. And a lot of people didn't like it. You may have noticed a lot of people didn't like it. But it came right out of the story that is in the section of the Bible that we're studying in this Red Letter Talks, where Jesus, in order to show us what God was like, washed feet. And if you didn't know this story and were just hearing it for the first time, you could be truly shocked as you found out that God isn't what we thought. God is the kind of God who actually washes feet. It strikes me that the world, even as so much of the West rejects Christianity, can't get over Jesus. And so much of the reaction really does come down to the last 24 hours of Jesus' life, the section of the Bible that we're in today. So maybe you saw a couple of months ago in the Summer Olympics when the opening ceremony in France happened, and it was this. And I didn't watch the ceremony, but I saw on my social media feeds, people were all over the place with it. Many were deeply offended. Many were offended that others were offended. And it was kind of confusing for me because everybody was on taking different sides. But one thing I noticed was that a lot of Christian leaders that I highly respect, people like the priest Robert Barron, Andy Stanley, Jonathan Pagoa, were saying, no, this is insulting and offensive. And they are not people that get offended easily. There were a lot of people who said, no, it's not actually about the Last Supper. This is about the Festival of Dionysus. And I honestly think Christians got gaslighted into thinking, oh, it wasn't about that. But it wasn't Dionysus. One of the organizers of the event admitted it was inspired by the Last Supper. The person in the middle actually posted this on Instagram immediately afterwards. And then when the backlash started, she took it off and said, no, it was about the Festival of Dionysus. And, you know, just I think a lot of the reason we don't get what really happened is because we're Americans and you don't know it more than English. But in France, it's actually called the event the opening ceremony was named the Célène, the Seine on the Seine on de la Seine, which that word, the Seine, is actually the title of the Lord's Supper painting, The Last Supper by Da Vinci. And it's also the way you pronounce the stage and the river that it was on. Those are all three pronounced the same way. And so it was obviously a reference to that. But another reason is because we don't get culture. And France is deeply post-Christian. It was Catholic for many generations. And post-Christianity is basically like teenagers reacting against their parents. And I get that because I'm a parent and I have teenagers. And I've seen many times me be like, what'd you just say? Oh, nothing, Dad, nothing. You know, that's what that was. And I got to tell you, I was disappointed with both the Olympics and Christians' response to it because it was billed as an updating of a more inclusive symbol. But it didn't feel inclusive. It felt to me sectarian and frankly colonial as this new updated symbol wrote off the majority of the world. People who are Buddhist, people who are Muslim, people who are Christians and Jews who have a more traditional view. And it smacked to me of chronological snobbery that hadn't dealt with what it was actually writing off and didn't know what they were actually making fun of. Because the very thing that it was mocking is the Last Supper, which Jesus gives us a table. And it's not our table. We can't exclude anybody. It's Jesus's table. And he washes feet at this table, showing us what God is like. And his last prayer were that Christians would rise above all their differences and have unity. You do know the Christian gospel is the most inclusive, international, multi-ethnic, multi-generational movement the world has ever known. And there's not a close second. You may think the Paris ceremony was more inclusive, and I would say that tells me more about you than it does the ceremony. It tells me that you're probably pretty wealthy, you're probably pretty educated, and you're probably white. Because that is a very European point of view. Now, on the other hand, progressives are not the only one who have a problem with God. That ad that I just showed you in the Super Bowl that last year, in the ad you see police officer washing a black man's feet, a Catholic priest washing the feet of a man with same-sex attraction, an abortion protester washing the feet of a woman in line for an abortion, suburban housewife washing the feet of an immigrant Muslims, and the ad ends with, "Jesus didn't teach hate, he washed feet." And I loved the ad. And then I realized I may have been the only one who loved the ad. Because people immediately were like, "Jesus didn't wash feet," or "it didn't wash everybody's feet." And I was like, "Yeah, but he washed Judas's feet." And that'd be at the top of my list if I'm Jesus, of who I didn't want to wash his feet. The Matt Walsh, the Daily Wire commentator, called the ads heretical. He added a cuss word and he said, "Putting out an ad that invites narcissistic, prideful, unrepentant sinners to come get their feet washed is bad, actually." To which I would say, did Jesus have any choice but to wash sinners' feet? In my experience, feet are always attached to sinners. He had no choice. And if you don't get this about Jesus, you don't get Jesus.
That's right.
It is God's kindness that leads people to repentance. It is God's kindness that led you to repentance. And if you forget God's kindness, God help us. I want to say something, as long as I'm being punchy, I want to say something about this. The election happened this week, and I want to say I was really proud of how this church responded. It was a very divisive season. And I know this week some of us are happy, some of us are sad. Our country is too divided, and we must as a church not follow the way of our country. And because we care so much about reaching people far from God, I want to say this. And not always, but often, people who are far from God have the wrong perception about who we are. I read an article in the New York Times a couple of days ago that made me realize a lot of people are scared of Christians right now. There are some Christians who think that you can force the way of Jesus on people. That's called Christian nationalism. And Jesus was tempted by that in the desert. You remember when Satan said, "I'll give you all the powers and kingdoms of this world if you will just bow down and worship me." And Jesus said no, because that's not how he works. There are some Christians, there are some people on the outside of our faith who think that Christians are more like the Roman centurion holding the spear than the Messiah who had it stuck in him. And I want you to know there may be churches like that in America. Not a ton, but there are churches like that in America, and this is not one of them.
That's right.
Have you noticed we don't force baptize anybody? I don't sneak into people's bedrooms to make sure they're obeying Jesus. I think it's great for you to obey Jesus in your bedroom. I don't sneak into people's bank accounts at this church and make sure they're obeying Jesus, even though I think it's great for you to obey Jesus with your finances. We think, because Jesus taught us this, the way of Jesus must be chosen, not coerced. And I started this way because I think the world can't get over the last 24 hours of Jesus's life. And what we want to do in a post-Christian West is we want to hold on to the parts of Jesus that we like, and write off the rest. So maybe you like his sexual ethic, but not his stance on power and money. Or maybe you love his emphasis on love, but not what it says, what he says about what it means to be a person of God with your body. And we want, as a church, to not be those kinds of people. Where God challenges us, we want to submit. We want to give him our whole life, soul, spirit, and body. And we will try, no matter what cultural pressures we face, to follow him and what he says in these talks. And if we do, you will have trouble. That's what he says. In fact, here's just a sampling of it. If the world hates you, keep in mind it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. You'd be real popular on social media. As it is, you do not belong to the world. I have chosen you out of the world. You've been called out of the world. That's why the world hates you. Remember what I told you. A servant is not greater than his master. And if they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. If they obeyed my teaching, they will obey yours also. They will treat you this way because of my name, for they do not know the one who sent me. So maybe have a little compassion for these people. And just like Jesus and the early Christians, be able to be the kind of man or woman who prays for those who persecute you. If I had not come and spoken to them, they would not be guilty of sin, but now they have no excuse for their sin. All this I have told you so that you will not fall away. And then in John 16, at the end of these red letter talks, he says, they will put you out of the synagogue. You're going to be excluded. You will know what that's like. In fact, the time is coming that anyone who kills you will think they are offering a service to God. They will do such things because they have not known the Father or me. And then at the end of the talk, he says, in this world, you will have trouble. I'm telling you these things so that you may have peace, because I have overcome the world. What is the world here Jesus is talking about? Well, it's the created order, but it's also the people who live in it, who have rebelled against their creator. Jesus has come into the world because John tells us God so loves the world. The world that doesn't love God, God still loves. And so he sent his son. But this world is under a dark spell. An evil enchantment ruled by the prince of the world, Satan, who rules by lies, and they are lies that lead to death. Satan's job description is to steal, kill, and destroy. Wherever you see death and destruction, that's his fingerprints. But the thing is, they're lies we love to believe. They feel like settling into a warm bath. They're lies like about ourselves. I'm basically good. About our enemies. They are not good. They are evil and very much unlike me. About our desires. I should follow my heart. I should be true to myself. About our sin and vices. I can quit anytime. That doesn't control me. About our relationships. My family doesn't appreciate me. They don't love me the way I deserve. I deserve a different marriage. The kids are resilient. They'll be fine. And listen, I have learned this about Jesus in my life. You can have the best sounding arguments. Some of you have them rolling around in your head right now. You can have the best sounding arguments, and Jesus will let you win that argument and lose at life. Because there is a gap between our choices and our consequences. It will maybe take some time for you to realize that Satan, his lies sound good, but it leads to death and destruction, because God isn't pushy. Jesus doesn't force himself on anyone. And for those with ears to hear and a submitted heart, he wants to give us life and life to the full. And he wants us not just to know information about God, but to experience the love of God and the Spirit of God. Okay, so here's what Jesus says. In John 13 through 17, he's initiating the Lord's Supper, this institution that we have done, and Christians around the world under mango trees and in cathedrals and in buildings like this have done ever since. There's not been a Sunday since that somebody hasn't done this. And he uses, and this is hard for us to see because we don't have the Jewish imagination, but he's using wedding language. A groom proposing to a bride when he institutes this new covenant and this new command, which is to love one another as we have been loved by him. And all throughout the Gospel of John, we've been hearing Jesus talk about remaining in him and eating his body and drinking his blood. So remember in John 6, right after he had fed the 5,000 and multiplied the loaves, he speaks in what a lot of people think is a communion language, because he's trying to prepare the stage for this moment. Here's what he said: for my flesh is real food and my blood is real drink, and whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood, read those three words with me, remains in me and I in them, just as the living Father sent me and I live because of the Father. So the one who feeds on me will live because of me. What we just did, what Christians around the world, we just joined with them in doing, is a way of remaining in Jesus. That's the language that Jesus uses in this new covenant. And what he's saying, why he's talking like a groom proposing to his bride, is what he's saying is what I'm doing is a macrocosm of the whole story that began in a garden with Adam and Eve. Marriage is this microcosm. It's a sacrament, which means it's like a window. And a window is something you look through, not something you look to. That the way the husband loves his wife, the way the wife loves his husband, is an image of God's love that he's trying to show the world. So back to theology of the body for just a second. Do you know what Jews and Christians mean when they say, you're made in the image of God? Well, it means something. And it's not just a cliche. It means that your body, your actual body that you're in right now, that you are right now, is good. In fact, remember this from the Theology of the Body series? It's that saying, God made your body and your body is good. Let's all say that together again. God made your body and your body is good. In fact, Christianity says, because of Jesus, that your body and only your body can make the invisible visible. It can make God visible. That's what it means to say you've been made in the image of God. And John, later on, as he's writing to a church about what he's learned from his years with Jesus, says this: whoever claims to love God yet hates a brother or sister, is it wrong? No, they're a liar. For whoever does not love their brother or sister who they have seen cannot love God who they have not seen. This is what it means to be made in the image of God. That no matter who you are, where you're from, what you've done or haven't done in your life, no matter what you believe or don't believe, no matter how young or old or what nationality you are, you show the world what God is like. And so you treat people accordingly, followers of Jesus. The whole modern Western world has gone off the rails by the simple idea that all we really are is evolved animals. So your body's just meat and your brain is just firing chemicals. There's not really such a thing as joy or love. It's just pistons firing in this machine of a body that you have. And in your heart of hearts, no matter what you do or do not believe, you know better than that. The way Chesterton said it was this: the simplest truth about man is that he is a very strange being, almost in the sense of being a stranger on the earth. In all truth, he has much more of the external appearance of one bringing alien habits from another land than a mere growth of this one. You feel this, right? Yes, we're a part of this creation. Yes, we are created beings, but we look around and there's nothing like a human being. There's nothing like a human person. And so when it comes to your body, a lot of us have, maybe most of us or even all of us have shame when it comes to our body. Maybe it's because of things we've done with it or things that have been done to it. But your body and only your body can show the world what God is like. And so since we have so much shame, maybe the best way to understand what Jesus is saying is to go back to the Garden of Eden before sin enters the world and consider what it was like to be them. So think about it like this. If you're at home alone and you're taking a shower, you don't feel any shame. But if some stranger comes in, what do you immediately do? Come on. Yeah, you'd cover up. Why? Because instinctively, you know your body is good and it's not meant to be used or abused. Flip that. That's what Adam and Eve felt. They knew their body was good. And since there was no lust, there was not this desire to use another person for a means to an end. They could offer their bodies to one another as a gift. And God made us male and female, Adam and Eve, the way he did, to tell a story. What is the story that God wanted to tell? Did you know that Christians, and this is not new to me, this is not new, this is thousands of years old, that Christians call when a man and woman come together? Communion, as in common union. I know some of you are like, all right, get the kids. He's gone off the deep end. But listen, You know this is true. This is why Jesus talks the way he does in the red letter talks. And Paul makes it more explicit when he's talking in Ephesians about a marriage. And then he steps back and he's like, look, this is a mega mystery. Mega mysterion is how he says it. And he's saying, when I'm talking about marriage, I'm actually talking about Jesus and his bride, the church. When God wants to show the Israelites how they're breaking his heart, he taps a prophet named Hosea on the shoulder and he says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go marry a promiscuous woman who's going to cheat on you. I want them to see that's what my heart is like towards them. To which I would be like, can I just like do some research and read some books? But the point is that in Christian theology, becoming one flesh is not joining of two bodies. That's what animals do. It's a sacrament which corresponds to the communion of persons. Animals are able to mate. They cannot enter communion. Only persons are able to give the gift of self and establish a common union. And here's where things get so good. What happens in the natural course of things when a man and woman come together? They create a third. Just like the inner life of God, who is three in one, who Christians, Orthodox Christians around the world, which is a majority of the Christian population, Orthodox, like Eastern Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, the way they talk about God is this holy trinity, this like a dance, a family that's always exchanging love. And Jesus in this moment is inviting us into this. Jesus reveals the inmost secret of God, that God is love. He's an eternal exchange of love. Understood through the sacrament of marriage, you understand. And by the way, that word gender, it's where we get the word generation, generate, genital. It's a word that means the genders are not competitive. They're designed for one another. A man's body doesn't make sense by itself. A woman's body doesn't make sense by itself. They were made for each other. They complement each other. And in the natural course of events, when they come together, they create a third. When a man and woman make love, they actually make something. Just like the inner nature of God. Remember how God says in Genesis 1, let us make man in our own image. This means something significant for you no matter what you do or do not believe. And it appeals to your deepest moral intuitions, which is this. You are not an accident. You were made in love and for love. Love is your origin and your destiny. The union of the sexes is the microcosm, the sign in the world for our call to union with God. And the reason Christians have historically said, like, hey, sex is not just bodily instincts against Freud and you know, all his minions who have captured the cultural imagination. Christians have said, no, this is holy and sacred, and it can't just be whoever, whenever, for whatever. It's because in the marriage act, we are imaging the very inner life of God, who is always self-donating, self-emptying, giving himself away, others-centered and generous. So Jesus here is about to start talking about the third, the Spirit. And what this means is Jesus has framed it in the most intimate personal interaction someone could have. And then he says, and God is going to send you himself to be with you. What this means is that Jesus is showing us what God is like. And it's not who we thought. God is not some angry old man in the sky. God is not some tyrant. God is not some slave driver ready to strike us down. He's not some impersonal, uncaused cause. He is an eternal exchange of love who had no other reason for creating you except for an overflow of his love and goodness. And Jesus is inviting us, you, baptized believer, into the very community and experience of God, the family of love that is at the heart of all reality and the center of truth. And here's how Jesus says it in John 14. If you love me, keep my commands, and I will ask the Father, and he will give you another advocate. That's interesting. Who's the first advocate? We'll get back to that. He'll give you another advocate to help you and be with you forever. The Spirit of truth. The world cannot accept him because it neither sees him or knows him, but you know him, for he lives with you and will be in you. I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you. Before long, the world will not see me anymore, but you will see me. Because I live, you also will live. On that day, you will realize that I am in the Father, and you are in me, and I am in you. And whoever has my commands and keeps them is the one who loves me. The one who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I too will love them and show myself to them. You are never alone. You are not orphans. Do you realize this communion, what it has done? It has not just created an inner peace. The Spirit of God does live inside of you, baptized believer. You have the Spirit of truth, but that's not all. Because the way God makes his love visible is through your body. And in communion, it's communion, community, the community of our bodies. So this week, Jimmy Cohen and I were at the largest African-American gathering in Churches of Christ. Orpheus Hayward, who is an amazing preacher and a really dear friend. And the whole time there, it was just the most joyful thing. And everywhere I went, people found out that Brother JC and Glenda were at this church. And I heard stories from the leaders who were like, they did our wedding. They baptized me. There was immediate community. No matter where we were, no matter what part of the world we were. About an hour ago, Eden and Samuel were driving to Pinnacle Mountain to meet the rest of the youth group and the adultish group for their Devo that they were having. And they got in a real bad wreck. And both airbags went off. And they're okay. But they're stuck on the side of this really curvy, wet road, and it's a blind curve, and all they're doing is talking to Leslie. And they're confused and disoriented, and then out of nowhere, Jamie Kime shows up and says, get in the car, and drives them off. And now the police think Eden's drunk and fled the scene, but she's not. And also, we're in the market for a new vehicle. But I say all that to say, do you realize what a gift this is? It's not just a theory. It's reality. And the hand of God, you'll never convince me the hand of God wasn't by the person who led our small group for the last few years, showing up seconds after that happened. You're never alone. God does not abandon us or leave us as orphans. I am going to leave you right after this sermon, though, because I have to go check on them, and Josh is going to do the sending, and he'll probably do a subpar job, but it's... I read an article a couple of weeks ago by a young British woman who's Gen Z. Her name is Freya India, and Freya wrote an article called The Age of Abandonment, and it's so sad. She said, I've written a lot about our generation, our fear of love, our fear of life. But our ultimate fear underneath it is our fear of abandonment, because we grew up, the majority of teenagers in Britain as of this moment grew up in broken homes. She said, families have come apart in every generation, but even a few decades ago, they still had community. They had neighborhoods. They had institutions that they were a part of or they could depend on. And she said, now when my generation thinks community, we think of this hollow out nothing. Things like Reddit, things like abstract terms like the mental health community. And it's just so bleak. And she says, there's a loss of faith, not just in religion, but in all social bonds. Forget loving our neighbors. We can't make eye contact with our neighbors. Nothing holds us together. And on top of that, there's no sympathy for children of divorce. In part, for good reasons, like we tried to normalize this, right? We're trying to get rid of the shame around divorce, but whenever you take away the stigma, you add it to the people who are dealing with the consequences of it. And so when you normalize something, you stigmatize the reaction. And so when marriages end, kids hear the message, what did you expect? Your friends are the same way. What's wrong with you? It's just a contract. Kids are resilient. all that tells you that abandonment is just trivial, and you feel deeply affected by it, then you might be the problem. And anyone who tries to name the pain is accused of having some kind of political agenda or just being able to not control their feelings. And she said, the feeling that we're left with is that nobody has our back. We can't trust anyone. The world is terrifying, and we're powerless, and we can't depend on anyone. You're always abandoned. I see this everywhere, she says. It's at the core of all of our problems. It's why we can't trust people, why we're hypersensitive to criticism, by low self-esteem, constant need for external validation. These are all abandonment complexes. Listen, I know there's all kinds of shame around divorce in the church, and I want you to hear this. Jesus can forgive anything. And maybe sometimes it's a necessary evil, but it is an evil, and it does have consequences. And in my experience, the people who are the most familiar with this and most encouraging for me to say this kind of stuff are the people who have gone through the pain of divorce. But here's the gospel, baptized believer. No matter the shape of your family or your home, for whatever you've gone through, you will never be alone. For divorced families, there is a real and perfect family that all our families are just an echo of. Jesus has adopted us into that family, and it will never be broken. But this family, while it is for everyone, it is not for everybody. Jesus consistently let people walk away from him. This is one of the things that surprises people about the Gospel of John, because it's so warm and loving. It's also the most sectarian of the four Gospels. Jesus is very clear, in and out, black and white, lies or truth, light or darkness. He is the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through him. And before you get upset about that, remember what this way is. It's the way of foot washing. It's the way of service, not pride. It's a way of humility, not arrogance. And then Jesus goes on in chapter 14, starting in verse 23. He says this, anyone who loves me will obey my teaching. My Father will love them, and we will come to them and make our home with them. Anyone who does not love me will not obey my teaching. These words you hear are not my own. They belong to the Father who sent me. All this I have spoken while I'm still with you, but the Advocate, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, will teach you all the things and will remind you of everything I have said to you. Peace I leave you. My peace I give you. And I don't give you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled and do not be afraid. You heard me say, I'm going away and I'm coming back. If you loved me, you would be glad that I'm going to the Father. For the Father is greater than I. We have trouble in this world because the prince of the world, who has led the world astray with lies, who's recently just led Judas astray with lies. Judas is going to have killed himself within hours of him betraying Jesus, because that's Satan's fingerprints, to kill, steal, and destroy. This Satan has dominion over the world, but he doesn't have dominion over Jesus. Jesus, who is about to go through the hardest weekend in human history, is telling us about a peace that is different, that can sustain us through anything. Not the kind of peace the world has, right? Peace that is the world's peace. You drink the world's peace. That works for a few years. You smoke the world's peace. You pop a pill for the world's peace. And Jesus is saying, I give you a better version of peace than that. In fact, I am giving you an advocate that is better than me. Better than Jesus? Jesus seems to assume that what we, the average Christian experience right now, if we can dwell in it and pay attention to it and turn off the noise, is better than him being here in person. I would love for Jesus to be here in the flesh. And so would you and billions of other people. I mean, imagine trying to talk to him. There'd be lines for years. And Jesus is saying, you have access to my power and my presence right now. And to my peace. To some very anxious people, Jesus is promising us another way. And it's a peace that's exemplified by Jesus in the end of this. I have told you now before it happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe. Put that slide up, please. I will not say much more to you, for the prince of this world is coming, but he has no hold over me. But he comes so that the world may learn that I love the Father and do exactly what my Father commands. Jesus is about to go through the hardest moments in human history. And he's thinking of us and promising us that we will never be alone. You are in the family of God. And he will send another advocate. Who's the first advocate? Him. He is our older brother in this family. One of the comedians I really like is this guy named Brian Regan. He grew up in a family of 8 kids. And he said, when you have a bunch of kids, your mom will often tell you, just go outside into the yard and come up with some activities. So one of the activities they came up with was stuff like staring at the sun to see who could... to see who could do it the longest. And then his mom was like, that's not a good activity. And he's like, yeah, we were about to quit. It's not that great. Yeah. But he said, inevitably, when you play out in the yard, one of you would get hurt. And you didn't dread being the kid that got hurt. You dreaded being the kid who was told to go tell mom. And I'm telling you, as a dad of 5 kids, this is spot on. Because you'll just be sitting in your, you know, living room or something, and all of a sudden, one of the kids runs in at full speed and stops and is like, hey, everything's fine. Just ran in here at full speed, no reason. Hey, Dad, you know Joel? Remember Joel? You know how Joel's arm does this? Yeah, it doesn't do that anymore. And we were thinking, since you were already getting out, to get milk and stuff, that since you were getting out anyway, that maybe you could just run Joel by the hospital on your way. Jesus is a better advocate than that. He is our older brother. He speaks to God on our behalf. He looks at the dumpster fire that we've made of our lives and says, look at their lives through me. Through what he did for us that we could not do for ourselves. Through the blood on his cross. The blood through his cross that covers over you, forgiven, baptized believer. And that's not all. He gives us his presence. He gives us his power inside of you. The Holy Spirit, the same Spirit that raised Jesus from the dead, lives inside of us. Jesus is our first advocate. His life and death paid a debt we could not pay, and that debt is paid in full. But the Spirit of God, Jesus uses the word paraclete. Let me hear you say paraclete. It means comforter. It means helper. It means supporter. It means coming alongside of. It means you'll never be alone. You have the family of God made by God. Through the Spirit of God. Through the love of God. Jesus has promised. And he's never broken his promises. That he will never forsake us or abandon us. So to all the lonely brothers and sisters out there, look to your left and right. To image bearers of God who have the Spirit of God. And we are a part of the family of God. When you're by yourself, pay attention to what God is doing. Listen to God's still voice. Hear him, the Spirit of truth, speak to you. About who you are. About who he is. You are never alone. And believe it or not, that's still true. I want to invite our prayer teams to take their places around the room. In a world of loneliness and a world of hurt, Jesus promised us we would have trouble. But we don't have to go through this alone or like everybody else. We have the Comforter who loves to give comfort.